Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Mem Amdala by the two dots. The Braita begins, Tanu Banan, Apitropsim Mishalmim Min Ha'aliyah, that the guardians of the Yitomim have to pay out of their own estate for damage that is done by a Shor Mu'ad that is under their auspices. This is in accordance with the conclusion of the Gemara in yesterday's daf, that when it comes to a Shor Mu'ad that is entrusted to the guardian is responsible for the Nezek that is done, and whether he can go and collect later on for the Yitomim when they get older, it is a separate issue. But what's the chiddush here in the Braita is the Ein Mishalmim Kofer, that the Opitropsim, these guardians, don't pay for Kofer if the Shor goes ahead and kills another individual, which would be the case in a normal situation when you have Baalim and a Shor Mu'ad kills, then there is requirement of paying Kofer. But over here we exempt the Opitropsim. The guardians are not chayav to pay Kofer. Mantana Kufra Kapara. Who is the one who believes that Kapara, the kofar, is a form of kapara? Viatme lavne kaparaninu. And the Yitomim, who are minors, are not relevant to the world of kapara. Samar of Chista, it must be Rabbi Shmuel Benosh, Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokahi. It must be accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Shmuel Benosh, Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokahi, Netanya. Benatan pidyon nafsho. That a person has to give redemption of his soul. This is the balim of the Shor Mu'ad that kills another individual. There it says, v'natan pidyon nafsho. The question is, how do you calculate the pidyon, the redemption, that he has to pay in order to attain that kapara? So we have the Tanakama's view, which is Demei Nizak, who says it based on the value of the party that was killed. Rabbi Shmuel Benosh, Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokahi, Omer Demei Mazik. It's according to the value of the Baalim that owned the animal that did the damage, or here did the killing. That is how we assess the value of the kapara or kofar that has to be paid in this instance. My lav bahaka mitlige. Let us assume that the machloket here between the Rabbonon and Rabbi Shmuel Benosh, Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokahi is the following. The Rabbonon savre kufra mimonahu, that they believe that kofar is a monetary payment. In essence, it is just a extreme form of nezek. Nezek is damage to the individual where you're making restitution. Death is just the ultimate form of nezek, where you've terminated any residual value in the individual, and therefore you're going to have to pay for that, and therefore kofar here is just a equivalent of mamona, where you're paying for the monetary value of the deceased, and that's why you have to assess it based on the nizak. Rabbi Shmuel Benosh, Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokahi, savar kufra kapara. On the other hand, Rabbi Shmuel Benosh, Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokahi believes that the kofar that's being paid here, in essence, is a redemption of the soul of the individual who caused the problem, meaning the owner of the animal. And in order to save himself, in order to attain atonement, he has to now redeem himself. How does he do that? He pays money for his worth in order to redeem himself. Now the money in the end will go to the nizak, but nevertheless, the kapara is determined by the individual who is the responsible party over here. So the assumption of Rav Chista is that their machloket revolves around this factor. Whether you assess the value based on the nizak or the mazik revolves around whether you consider a kofar to be mamon or whether you consider a kofar to be kapara. And now there are nafkaminot as to whether you consider it to be kapara or you consider it to be mamona. One of them is what we're discussing now, is the obligation of the yitomim in order to make compensation and restitution over here. If it's considered to be kapara, then the Yitomim, who are minors, are not, quote-unquote, b'nei kapara, and therefore they would not be obligated to make payment. On the other hand, if you think it's mamon, if you think it's a monetary obligation, then that monetary obligation should devolve upon them, or the guardian in this case, who is responsible for their property on their behalf. Other nafkaminot between them would be whether you have the ability to be mochel on the item, whether you can forgive the payment. If you believe that it's mamona, if it's a regular monetary payment, it would seem that you would have the ability as the nizak to forgive the individuals, or truthfully, it's not the nizak himself because he's not alive anymore, but the yoshima, the nizak, could forgive the payment because it's a monetary payment to them. And then they have a right as recipients of that monetary payment to forgive it. On the other hand, if it's a din in kapara, it's a din in atonement, then the nizak or the receipt of the money by the yoshima, the nizak, has nothing to do with the kapara. The kapara is an obligation on the mazik, and therefore the nizak or the yoshima, the nizak, cannot forgive that payment. Now, that seemingly would be a nafkamina between them. On the other hand, Tosafot, later on in Daf Mem Gimel, seems to indicate that when it comes to kofar, that one cannot be mochel versus damim, that they can be mochel. And over there, there's no differentiation between whether kufra kapara or kufra mamona. And it might be that according to the Bali at Tosafot, even if it's kufra mamona, that you wouldn't be able to forgive it. But according to many, that would be a nafkamina between kufra kapara and kufra mamona. The other thing is whether if the person has no money with which to make the compensation or the payment, then how much do we press on them to make this payment? In a case where they own money and they're bankrupt, then in a case where it's nezek or it's a monetary obligation, then they can't pay. So if they can't pay, they can't pay, and we let it go. Because it's like any other obligation or any other debt that is outstanding for them. On the other hand, if it is associated with kapara, then we would force the person or compel the person to make the payment despite the difficulty monetarily, because it's not really associated with a normal debt. It's associated with kapara, attaining atonement. And therefore, that should supersede the monetary problem. And they should have to make this compensation or stretch to make this compensation, and as long as the kapara has not been attained. The other possible nafkamina will be whether you need to have a toveya. Do you need to have a claimant that comes and asks for the payment? And then you have the defendant or the one who the payee who's going to make the payment, and you have to go to Beit Din and have Beit Din give a psak din that the person owes the money. Or is it simply the obligation of the mazik to pay the money simply because they require kapara? So similarly, another nafkamina between them would be that if it's kufra kapara, then the obligation of the mazik to pay should be independent of any formal judicial process. On the other hand, if it's a monetary obligation, it should be subject to any other judicial process, and therefore you would need a claimant to come and ask for the money, and then you would have a psak din of the Beit Din to obligate the party to pay the money. Although the Ibn Ezel himself suggests over here that that's not the case, even according to the one who says kufra kapara, it's still subject to din, still subject to judicial process and requires a claimant. And it also might have nafkamino to whether the property of the mazik is encumbered to the payment of this kofar. If it's a monetary obligation, then a lien would then exist in all the property or all the possessions of the mazik, like any other debt that is outstanding. Then if it's kapara, as we'll see later in today's daf, there's a possibility that it would not then create a lien or an encumbrance on the property of the mazik, but rather it's the obligation of the mazik to pay, and if he wants the atonement, if he wants kapara, then he's got to make the payment, but that doesn't mean that there's any monetary obligation or shibud on the property. Again, the Avnei Nezer in Yoredeya, Chelek Aleph, Simen Kuf Samechet, Ot Gimel, suggests that even if you say kufra kapara, that the nechasim of the mazik are mishubadim. So these are possible nafkamino to whether it is kufra kapara or kufra mamona. In some of these cases, the rishonim and achronim seem to blur and say that it's not the case, but at least we've laid out at least possibilities as to what the difference would be if you think it's mamona or kapara. Again, the major difference is how you view the compensation over here. Do you simply see it as enhanced nezek? Or do you see this as atonement for the individual who was posheya, was negligent in allowing his possessions to kill another person? And that was the difference between kufra mamona or kufra kapara. Now, as far as the apitropsim, the guardians themselves, here the Gemara assumes that they're not going to pay because of the fact that either the yatomim are not chayav, or because we can't obligate them. The question is, why can't we obligate them? If we can obligate them to pay the nezek when it comes to muad, why can't we obligate them by the case of kofar? Now, the answer to that question, in all likelihood, is because then nobody's going to accept the job as a guardian for the yitomim, because that is something that would put them in a very difficult predicament, and for that reason, maybe they wouldn't accept the job. And so what you have to suggest over here is when the guardians take on this job, they accept responsibility for watching the shore, accept responsibility for damage that's done as a muad, but they do not accept responsibility for the possibility that this animal will kill another individual and be responsible to pay the kapara. So now the Gemara says, no, Amara Papa, look, the Kuleyama Kufra Kaparahu. Everybody believes that kofar is a form of atonement. Their machloket is about Rabbanan Savre Bidin Izak Shaminan, Rabbi Saul Beno Shir Rabbi Yochanan Merboka Savre Bidin Mazik Shaminan. That their machloket simply is about how you assess the level of kofar that one has to pay. My time of the Rabbanon. So what is the reasoning behind the Rabbanon Shita? That has to do with the psukim that are found. Nemar shita lamato, and nemar shita lamalo. The term shita is used both earlier on in the psukim in Parshat Mishpatim, which is in the case of an individual who hits a woman and then causes the woman to miscarry. Over there it says that v'chinatzu anashim v'nagfu isha hara v'yatzu yiladah v'lo yeh ason anoshi anesh kasher yashit alav bala isha v'natan b'flilim. So here the responsible party who causes the woman to miscarry, assuming that there was no fatality here, the woman is still alive, then there's an obligation on the mazik to pay, and that is assumed by kasher yashit alav bala isha. The husband of the woman who had the miscarriage then will assess the damage that's done here, and then the mazik has to pay for it. And then later on in our parsha, with regards to a shor mu'ad, it says, "Vim shor nagachu mitmol shushom v'u'ad bivala v'lo yishmerenu v'mit ish o isha hashor yisakel v'gam balav yumat v'im kofer yushat alav." If there is kofer placed on him, natan pidyom nafsho kashchol asher yushat alav. So you see the word yushat that is used here, as well as the word yashit that was used before. Malahalan bin Izak, Avkan bin Izak, just like before when it talked about the causing a miscarriage, there the assessment of the value is the damage done, meaning the miscarriage that happened, you have to compensate the woman or the husband for that loss. So to over here, the assessment is going to be done bin Izak. The pasuk is very clear. It says he will give a redemption for his soul. And over here, the nafsho we're speaking about is the mazik himself that did the damage. The rabbanan say, in pidyon nafsho k'tiv, we agree with you that the redemption, the atonement for one's soul is that of the mazik. Mihu kishaminan bin nizak shaminan. When it comes to assessing the value that he has to pay in order to attain that atonement, that is done by the value of the nizak. And again, here, it's easy to see or understand how, even if you believe that kofar is kapara, why you would assess it based on the nizak or the mazik. In the case of the chachamim, based on the gzeret hakatuv, they say that it is based on the value of the nizak. But you can understand, if you're trying to attain atonement over here, you want to, in a sense, make reparations or compensation for the death that's caused. So you are paying money in lieu of the fact that your animal killed this individual and you're not being put to death, even though the Torah calls it a gam balav yumat. Yumat over there is that he has to pay the kofar. So how is balav yumat? In the sense that they have to now restore the individual that they killed. And that's how they attain kapara. On the other hand, Rabbi Yishmael Benosh, Rabbi Yochanan Ben Broka suggests that the pidyon nafsho is that you're redeeming oneself. The person who's the owner of the shore that did this killing now has to redeem himself. Instead of him going to be put to death, he pays the value himself in order to redeem himself from that death. And so therefore, it's also considered to be a form of kapara. So whether you assess it based on the mazik or the izak, you could explain or understand why kofar is considered to be kapara. But once we have done that, then we don't have a clear machloket here about who says kufra kapara, because everybody holds that kufra is kapara. So now, mishabeach le'rova l'Rav Nachman b'Rav Acha bar Yaakov. So Rova gave a lot of praise to Rav Nachman about Rav Acha bar Yaakov, the Adam Gadolhu, that it was a big guy in Torah, and we know that Rav Acha bar Yaakov was a Talmud of Rav Huna, was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, seemingly lived a decent amount of time, because he's still alive at the time of Rava and Rav Nachman, and he is telling him, this is a tremendous Talmud Chacham. So Rav Nachman says to Rava, listen, when he shows up in town, when you see him next, bring him over to me, I'd like to meet him. So that's what happened. Rava brings him over to Rav Nachman. So Rav Nachman says to Rav Acha bar Yaakov, why don't you ask me some questions? And we're going to see here the sharpness of Rav Acha bar Yaakov from the questions that he posed to Rav Nachman. When you have a shor that belongs to two partners, what is the methodology or the process by which one pays kofar in this case? Now the Rashba already clarifies over here that this question is only according to the one who says that kufra kapara. Because if it's kufra mamona, if you believe that kofar is mamon, then like in any other case where you have partners here, they would share in the compensation, they would share in the damage that is done. So if it's simply a monetary payment, then the answer to this question is simple, which is that they'd share the burden. The question only comes up really when it is kufra kapara. If you believe that kofar is a form of atonement, How exactly do they share the burden of the atonement? And we'll see in a second why it's not so simple to just assume that they'd pay 50% each. The Baalei HaTosafot suggests over here that the reason that he did not pose the question as being that, say, two owners of two shvarim came along and then killed an individual, together the two shvarim killed an individual, why don't we say that that's the case here? And why isn't that the question? Why do we have to have it in a case where it's a dual ownership or a joint ownership of a single shor? The Baalei HaTosafot clarify for us something that is clear in the psukim as well, which is that v'gam balav yumat, that's based on how the individual would have been put to death if they were the perpetrators of the crime here, meaning that if the Baalim killed themselves, then they'd be subject to these rules. Then so too, the kofar that they pay in the case where their possession, their animal does the damage, will be subject to the same rules. And if you remember, we had in Gemara and Sanhedrin, but we had it earlier here in Bava Kamma as well, there was a machlok between the Rabbonon and Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira as to what is the din when multiple people kill a single individual. According to the Chachamim, none of them are chayav because of the Gzeret HaKatuv, that none of them is the sole killer of this individual. And so that would be the same here as well, which is that since if human beings did this, they would not be subject to the death penalty. So too, in a case where two shvarim do this, they would not be subject to kofar, meaning the owners of the animals would not be subject to kofar. According to Yehuda ben Beteira, it would be the last one, like in the case by the hitting, the last one who hits him and knocks the life out of the individual, he is the responsible party. So too here, the shor that gives the final blow that kills the individual, his owner would be the one responsible for the kofar. So based on that, the Baalei HaTosafot say that that wouldn't have been a question that would have ended up or resulted in a problem, because there we would have an answer to the question, and that would be based on the machlok between the Rabbonah and Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira. So now, in this case of Mishalim high kofar v'high kofar, if each one of them was to pay kofar achad amar chokhmana v'lo shnei kofarim, then the Torah says you have to pay one kofar, and not pay double kofar. Now, the Baalei HaTosafot asks, wait a minute, we have other cases in the Torah where parties or joint owners or joint violators can be punished with the same punishment. For instance, Begabe Shabbat. If two people jointly do or violate an melacha on Shabbat, then each one of them individually is going to be chayav to bring a korban chatat if they did it b'shogeg. So why can't we say over here, just like over there, both of them bring a korban chatat, despite the fact there was only one violation of a melacha between them, nevertheless, each one of them individually is chayav to bring a chatat. So why can't we say the same thing over here, that each party individually has to pay kofar or make restitution in this case? Tosafot actually gives two answers to the question over here. The first of which is that by Shabbat it's different, because over there, the individuals who violate Shabbat, each one of them, if it was done by Mezid, would be chayav mita. Each one of them would be chayav karet or skila if they had a demon hatra'ah. So therefore, when it comes to the chatat, we can obligate each one of them individually, similar to the case by Mezid, where each one of them would be chayav. That is not true by here, by the case of kofar, which is that if the two of them did it together, that would not result v'mezid in a case where both of them would be subject to the death penalty. And therefore, in the case where it's their animal that is doing the damage, or their possession that is doing the damage, we are not going to say then that they are both chayavim kofar. So that's one way to distinguish between the cases, and to say that the obligation b'mezid there is what triggers the obligation b'shogeg. And so for that reason, in the case of the melacha on Shabbat, you can't have both parties be obligated, because both of them are going to be subject to the same punishment in that case. Well then, by the case of kofar, that would not be the case. The second answer the Baalei HaTosafot give is that, over here when they pay the kofar, the recipient of the kofar is the nizak or the yoshima of nizak. In this case, if they pay double kofar, that means that each party is contributing kofar here, paying full kofar. And that means that the Yoshim and the Izak end up with a double payment just because they were shutafim, just because they were partners that owned this shor. That would be an unfair or unreasonable outcome, as the Baalei HaTosafot say. Why should the Yoshim and the Izak be beneficiaries or make a gain on the loss of this individual's life just because they were partners that owned the shor? And that seems to be an untenable way to deal with the issue of kofar. On the other hand, when it comes to the chataot, bringing two chataot, the recipient, quote-unquote, of the chatat is Hashem. And when you go to Hekdesh or Gvoa, there's no issue with giving too much to Hashem are bringing too many korbanot, that's never an issue because we're not dealing with someone benefiting or profiting out of this situation. So therefore, by the chataot, we're okay with having multiple chataot. By the case of kofir, we're not comfortable having multiple people paying kofir to recipients who then are going to be the beneficiaries of that. So then the other alternative, the Gemara says, is hai chatzi kofir v'hai chatzi kofir. Let each one of them pay for half of the kofir, so together they're paying a full kofir, one kofir. Kofir shalem amar rachmana v'lo chatzi kofir. The Torah says you have to pay full kofir, not half kofir. And without having full kofir, it won't attain the atonement that you need. And even though there is a sheet of Rabbi Yosef Lili believes that just like by Eitam there's such a concept as Chatzi Nezek, so too by Kofir there is a concept of Chatzi Kofir. Over there, it's not Chatzi Kofir. The Chatzi Kofir is the total amount that needs to pay to get the Kapara. Therefore, the Chatzi Kofir is Kofir Shalem in that case. In this instance, the Kofir Shalem is the full amount. And now you're obligating each party only to pay half of it. Then how can they attain atonement when they're only paying half of the Kofir that is required? Before Rav Nachman had a chance to look at this and to study the issue, Amalei, Rav Acha ben Yaakov now posed him another question. It's not. We have a Mishnah. Chayavei arachin memashkanin otan. Someone has obligated themselves to give erech. They made a neder of arachin to pay based on the tables that are found at the end of Sefer Vayikra. Based on the gender and age of the individual, they're going to make payments to Hekdesh. Then, if they made that promise, then Beit Din can come and take a mashkon collateral to ensure they make payment of that. Chayavei chatot v'ashamot ein memashkanim otam. When it comes to an individual who is chayav to bring a chatat on Hashem, Beit Din doesn't intervene to take a mashkon collateral for them to bring those korbanot. The reason being is that by the case of chatat on Hashem, the individual obviously wants to attain atonement or kapara. We're not going to obligate them because they have a driving factor, an impetus to bring the korban in order to attain atonement. And so therefore, since they are self-motivated to do it, we don't need to take a collateral to force them to do this. The other hand, by arachin, which is not involved with kapara, over there we have to take collateral in order to compel the person to do what they said they were going to do in terms of promises of monetary donations to Hekdesh. So the question becomes here, chayavei kofrim mai. When it comes to kofir, what exactly is the situation? Kevin de kaparahu, again, according to the one who says kofir kapara, since it's kapara, kechatat vasham dami. Since it'll be like chatat vasham, which is mechamir chamir agavei velo bayil mashkunei. Since it is something that is serious issue for people, and they want to attain atonement, therefore we don't have to take any collateral over here because the person will, on their own volition, do this because they want to attain kapara. O Dilma Kevan Dilachavrehu Dubai Mitvale Mimonahu Valola Gvoahu Velo Khamir Ale Ubay Mashkune. Or maybe because over here the payment is not made to Hekdesh, but the payment is going to another party. In the eyes of the person that's giving it, they see it as being a monetary payment, and therefore they don't put it in the same category as a chatat v'asham. This is a human psychological phenomenon, which is that people are always willing to, quote-unquote, donate money, lose money when it goes to, let's call it a non-profit organization, to Hekdesh, to Hashem. On the other hand, people are loath to give money when the recipient or the beneficiary is another party, because then they feel their loss is enriching someone else, rather than it being, quote-unquote, a donation to Hekdesh or to the non-profit organization. So over here, too, maybe because the way that the kapara is structured, that it goes to another party, they won't assign to it the same stringencies or compelling nature to make atonement over here, and therefore we have to take a mashkon, we have to take collateral in order to compel them to do this. Inami came into hulo chata umumunehu da azik. Maybe because he didn't sin over here, and it's his possessions that did the damage, lo chamer milte lavei ubay mashkone. And therefore, he doesn't consider this to be such an issue, meaning that when you're talking about atonement, people think about their own personal actions and personal responsibility. They think of that being serious, and they want to bring kapara for that. But when it's their possession that did the damage, they don't associate that as tightly with themselves, and therefore they don't see this kapara as being as compelling, and therefore we're going to have to take, again, a mashkon, we're going to have to take collateral in order to compel them to do this. Amalei Shavkan. So, Rav Nachman says to Rav Acha bar Yaakov, all right, leave us already. Istagar b'kamaita. Rashi learns the word istagar b'kamaita, huzgarti v'nealamti b'rishuna. You already shut us down and silenced us with the first question, meaning that we're already taken or confused and have no answer to your first question. You don't need to bring a second question already to prove your erudition over here. It's clear here that your questions are strong questions and that we don't have any answers to the question. Then the Oruch has a different gears. You can see that on the side. The Oruch has the gears of Istanid, Perish, Chaliti, that I'm already weakened or sick, Mizota Sheila. Meaning that it's enough. The first one already made me sick or weak. I can't even handle a second one. You don't need to bring a second question down. And therefore, the questions are both left unresolved, which is interesting now because how do you paskin? So if you look in the Rambam paskins, that kol echad me'em mishalem kofer shalem, when it comes to partners in a case of kofer, each one of them has to pay full kofer. Shekol echad me'em tzarich kapara gemura. Each one of them needs full atonement over here. Now, the question or the problem with the Pesach of the Rambam is we're dealing with monetary matters over here. And in monetary matters, we go to Kula. So what the Magid Mishnah claims is Kevin de Pshitalan, Sheikh Hayavin Bekofer. Since we know over here that there's definitely an obligation of Kofer, the only question is how that Kofer gets paid. Meaning whether it's both parties have to pay full Kofer, or each one of them has to pay half Kofer, they don't pay at all. That is a issue that is not, again, about the obligation. The obligation already exists. And we don't classify that as being a safek mamon, but rather, we calculated that already as being a safek in the isur, that they need kapara, and we know that kofar needs to be paid. The only question is, who do we obligate, or how do we obligate it here? In that case, we're going to go to chumra and say both parties should pay the full kofar in order to attain kapara. And so that's how the Magid Mishnah explains the Rambam Psak, that each party here should pay kofar shalem, despite the fact that the Gemara does not end off with a conclusion. Now, in the case of the mashkon, there's actually a machloket in the Rishonim as to whom we are speaking about here that wants to take the collateral in order to get paid. You can see in the Balei HaTosafot already, he says that Chayavei Kofer Mai, Biyoshea Nizak Atzmo Mibayilei Im Yocholim Lemashkano. But the question here revolves around the Yorshim, the inheritors of the Nizak, as to whether they can demand collateral be given in order that they get the payment that they are deserving of over here. So the Balei HaTosafot and the Rashba both view this as a question for the Toveya, the claimants over here. Do they have a right to demand that the Mazik over here have collateral taken from him by Beit Din in order to ensure that he makes payment? But what's Pshita, what is clear, is that Beit Din can come along and take the collateral. That they have no question about. Beit Din can collateralize this guy without any questions asked. The only question is, can the claimants here demand collateral as private parties, not through the auspices, or not under the auspices of Beit Din? On the other hand, the Meiri believes that the question here about the kofar is going back based on the Mishnah in Arachin, which is that, does Beit Din have the right? Just like in Arachin, the question is, does Beit Din have the right to come into these parties and take collateral to enforce the Yad of Hekdesh? So too, the question here is, can Beit Din enter and force the individuals for a mashkon? And so it's a more fundamental question as to whether Beit Din has any rights here of taking a mashkon in the case of kofar. So again, the Rashba and the Balei HaTosafot see the question revolving around not the right to take a mashkon. Clearly, there is rights to take collateral over here. The only question is, who has a right to take collateral? Beit Din for sure can take collateral, but does a private party have a right to demand that Beit Din take collateral in order to ensure that they get their payment? Not simply that the individual, like Beit Din, would be doing to ensure that the person does or attains the kapara that they're supposed to. On the other hand, the Meiri sees the question revolving around Beit Din itself. Does Beit Din have any right here to compel the individual to give collateral? Because maybe the kapara itself is enough of a reason that Beit Din doesn't need to get involved or doesn't have the right to get involved. Once again here, the Rambam paskins, v'afal pi shekofer kaparahu mimashkenin et mish nitchayev bekofer bal korcho, that we force the individual to give a mashkon against his will, even though kofer is kapara. So now the question is why. So over here you have machloket in the mifarshei the Rambam. The Magid Mishnah says he learns like the Rashba. Of course, it's pshita that we give mashkimoto because that's what the Gemara said over here. The Gemara said that it's pashut that Beit Din can take it. The only question is, can they, as Balei HaTosafot say, the Yorshim of the Nizak collect over here? So the question is not about Beit Din, and that's what the Rambam paskins, that as far as Beit Din is concerned, of course they can take a mashkon, even if kufra is kapara. On the other hand, the Lechem Mishnah suggests that the Rambam was posek to chumra over here, That here we have a safek, and since we don't know the answer to the question, and we want to ensure that this party has a kapara, then we're going to enforce it through a mashkon, similar to what the Magid Mishnah said in the previous case with regards to the shutafim that are paying kofar. The Mitchat Chinuch gives a third possibility as to what the reasoning behind the Rambam's shita is, which is that, again here, there is no question that the party is chayav kofar. So as far as the monetary obligation, that we've already established that the case is that they will have to make the monetary payment over here. The only question at hand is, do we take collateral or we don't take collateral? That question is no longer a safek mamon, and therefore you would go to kula. That becomes a case of safek within isura or safek within a clear monetary obligation. And in that instance, we're going to go to chumrah to ensure that the payment is made, and that's why the Rambam here paskins the chumrah, even though it seemingly is a safek mamon or safek in payment. There you have the three different views within the Mefarshei Rambam as to why the Rambam paskins the chumrah in this case and says that Beit Din does have the right to take a mashkon, the Magid Mishnah, because fundamentally the Gemara believes here that the Beit Din can take it. There's only a question about the Yoshea Nizak, like the Rashbo and the Tosafot say. The Lech Mishnah simply says that because it's an inyan of Kapora, we paskin the chumrah. And for the Minchat Chinuch, it's no longer a case of Safek Mamon to be paskin the Kula, because the Mamon aspect has already been solved, which is that he is Chayav the Mamon. Therefore, it's no longer under the rubric of Safek Mamon, and in that case, Beit Din can act in order to ensure that the payment is made. Okay, now the Gemara continues. Tanu Rabbanan, Shalu b'chazkat tam, she'alo b'chazkat tam, he borrowed it, assuming that it was a tam, v'nimtza muad. And all of a sudden, the borrower of the animal finds out that the animal he borrowed is not a tam, but a muad. He was misled. Then the owners are responsible for half of the damage done, and the shoel, the borrower, is chayav for the other half of the damage done. Seemingly, the explanation for this would be that he was responsible for the animal as a tam, and as a tam, he would be chayav chatzi nezek, so he has to pay the chatzi nezek. On the other hand, as far as it being a mu'ad now, and it's really chayav nezek shalem, that's the problem of the owner, because the owner never disclosed that information. So therefore, the shoel will pay his half of the damage, and the owner will pay the other half of the damage. Hu'ad bebeit shoel. If, while he was borrowed, the animal becomes a mu'ad, meaning that it gored three times in the house of the person that borrowed it, or under his auspices, v'chziro lebalim, and then he returns it to the owners, balim mishalim chatzi nezek. There is a reset when he gives it back to the owners, and the owners get it back as if it's a tam. Again, seemingly here, what happens is that the change in ownership changes the dynamic of the animal. And so therefore, it was only a mu'ad under the auspices of the shoel, but it will not be a mu'ad under the auspices of the owner when it's returned to the owner. Vishoel patur miklum. And in that case, the shoel doesn't have any obligation now once he's returned it to the original owners. Amamar. So now the Gemara is going to discuss this. Sha'alo b'chazkat tam, b'nimtza muad. He borrowed it, assuming that it was a tam, and he finds out it's muad. Ba'alim mishalmim chatzi nezek, v'shoel chatzi nezek. Each party here contributes half the nezek, the shoel, because it was a tam as far as he was concerned, and the owners, because they didn't disclose the information that it was a muad. Va'amai, why is that the case? Ulemalei, why doesn't the borrower say over here, Torah shi'ilei, Arya lo shi'ilei? I borrowed an ox, I didn't borrow a lion. So, as far as the shoel is concerned, you're right, he's responsible for damage that would be done by a tam. But that assumes that the animal was a tam. Over here, he's assuming that he has a domesticated, calm animal. He didn't know that he borrowed this wild, goring animal. And therefore, when the animal goes out and gores, why should he be chayav even for the first half nezek, for the tam aspect of it? Because he didn't assume that he was getting an animal that had that trait or that character to it. He's saying, I only wanted a normal, regular shore ox. Instead, I got this wild lion of a shore that I couldn't control. And I didn't expect that. And so why should I be responsible at all? Rab says, it's the case here. He knew that the animal was a little wild. He knew the animal was wild, but he did not know that the animal was a muad. He said that he had information that the animal was not exactly your best-behaved animal. And then he had no information about being a mu'ad. So therefore now, again here, he's responsible for the tam aspect of it because he knows he's got to watch this animal. It's a wild animal. So when it goes out and does damage, he'd be responsible, assuming that it was a tam for that chatzi nezek. The muad aspect, the fact that he didn't know it was a muad, that will lay the other half compensation responsibility on the balim. Where it says, v'neimalei, tam shi'ilei, muad lo shi'ilei. Why can't he say back to the owners, listen, I borrowed a tam, or assuming it was a tam, and now you gave me a muad. So mishum damalei, sof, itam hava palga niska bait shlume. It says in the end, it doesn't really matter. You knew it was a wild shore, and had you borrowed it as a tam, and it was the same wild shore, you'd have to pay chatzi nezek. So you're not out of pocket anymore, had it been a tam, than it is now when it is a muad. Hashanami zil shlim palga niska. You should pay the half that you owe now, in the case where we owe the whole amount, and I'll make up the other difference, the balim say. So why doesn't the shuel say to him, listen, if it was a tam, there would be a cap on liability, because it would pay out of its goof. Now that it's a muad, I gotta pay out of pocket for the chatzi nezek. Mishum damarlei, because the owner can say back to the shuel, sof, at lab Torah bayit shlumei ledidei. In the end, don't you have to give me back a shore? So even if the payment was taken out of the goof ashore, then in the end, the individual would have to make restitution to the owners. So if the shore was the thing taken away for the payment, then the shuel then has to return a shore to the balim, which he doesn't have anymore. So now he's got to pay him the money anyway. So why does it matter whether you're paying out of pocket for the chatzi nezek versus if it was taken out of the shore itself? In either instance, you are going to have to make compensation, whether it's to the nizak, in the case here where you're paying out of pocket, or it's to the balim when the shore disappears and gets taken to pay the nizak, then you still have to replace the shore, whatever was taken, to the original owners. Tosfot asks the question and says, wait a minute, that's not always true, because if he paid me gufo, then there would be a cap on liability here. Even though you'd have to replace the shore to the original owner, there still would be a cap on liability, which is not the case if he is a muad. So the Baal Tosafot say here that it has to be a case where the shore is worth more than the chatzi nezek, meaning that it's not a case where there was a cap on liability. But ain't ochanami, if there was a cap on the liability because of the fact that the shore tam would have been worth less than the chatzi nezek that was done, then in that case, the shoel would have a good claim over here and say that you, by having it being a muad now, increased my liability over here. And in that case, maybe the shoel would not be chayav for that excess liability because he would have been capped out by the goof of the shore. B'nei Merlei, so why does he say to him, im tam hava, if it was a tam hava modina umifterina, I would have been modeh that the shore did the damage and I'd be patur. Based on the principle of Palganizga Knasa, which is that the half nezek is really a knas, and modeh b'knas is patur. So had I admitted to the item, I would have been patur. Now, as the Baal Tosafot say that this is not such a clear-cut question, because, first of all, there is a deya in the Gemara that even if a person's modeh b'knas, if edim come after the fact, then you snap patur from the knas. So according to that mandamar, there'd be no question over here. But the next section in the Gemara would then be the question on that shita. So you could have continued the question. So the Gemara just went with this flow because the same next question could have been asked on the other opinion. So filo the mandamar palga niska mimona, even according to one who says that half nezik is really mamona, not knas, or according to one who says that when you admit to knas and then edim come, you are chayav, nemale, let him say, itamo. If it was a tam, I would have taken it out into the swamp so they wouldn't have been able to grab the animal in order to get their payment from the goof of the animal. I would have taken away the collateral out of the situation. Now the Baal Tosafot say, wait a minute, this guy or this shoel thinks that the animal is a tam. And yet, despite the fact that he thinks it's a tam, he didn't admit to the knas, and he didn't take the animal out of here. So how can he make a claim? Had I known, I would have said modeh b'knas. Had I known, I would have taken it out of here. Meantime, he thought it was a tam and he didn't do any of these actions. So what the Baal Tosafot suggests is a case where, right after the damage, he finds out it's a muad, and therefore he can't take any of these actions because he knows it's a muad. But had he not known it's a muad and thought it's a tam, he would have to take these actions in order to gain this protection based on these claims. The second problem with this is, why exactly is this a good claim? The Baal Tosafot asks over here, wait a minute, have a ma'akla the agma tema, matana yuzuim kena yosesh lo kedin. Here this guy is violating the rights, or abrogating the rights of a party who deserved the payment out of the shore. He says, hey, you know what, I'll run it out of town, and then they won't be able to get it. Basically, I'll do something illegal in order to protect my assets over here. Why is that a good claim? And secondly, Beitin here will come to enforce the rights of the Nizak, and they're going to go get the animal from the swamp. So what is the benefit of taking it into the swamp or acting illegally? So the Baal Tosafot says, "Shavir nilrei shirotze lomar mitoch dvarim elu sheiti oseh hei Nizak mitpasheri mi bedavar muat ve'mocheli v'nimtza shif sadani kol yitaron." He says that this activity, even though in the end Beitin might come after it, or although even in the end I would have to pay for the nezek that is here, nevertheless, the putting of it into the agam would make the collection by the nizak harder, and therefore he'd be more willing to compromise on the payment instead of having to chase this animal down or get Beitin to get it. So my actions or my activity would have given me better negotiating leverage in this situation. So in essence, Tosafot does not really answer the question, because here the person is acting, quote-unquote, illegally. But despite that fact, what the Baal Tosafot is saying is that he doesn't intend to carry through fully with that illegal action and never pay the nezek. He just wants to use it as a leverage in his negotiation. And so therefore, maybe that is a good enough claim for him to make over here in order to give him better leverage. And he says that you lost me that leverage, because had I known this, had I had this information, meaning that had I known that it was a tom, I would have taken it out and run it out into this swamp. And again, assuming here that right after it happened, he knows it's a muad, so he doesn't do it. Because otherwise, he could have done it. Had he thought it was a tom, he should have run it out there and protected himself from having to make these payments. What's the case over here? It was a case where Beit Din came and ran away and grabbed the short. In that case, why are the Balim obligated for their Chatzin Nezek here? Name alay. Atafsate, the Torah, beyond the man, the Lomatzin Lishtuy Edina Ba'day. The Balim can say, listen, you allowed my animal to be taken by parties over whom I have no leverage. And if Beit Din's gonna do as they please, and you're allowing Beit Din to come and grab the animal, now put me in a predicament where I have no choice except to pay. So you actually caused me damage or a loss over here. So the obvious answer to that is, Mishum Damale, the Shual can say back to him, Ihadrita Nihalach, if I had returned it to you, La Minach Habu Shaklele, wouldn't they have come and taken it from you? Just because they confiscated it from me doesn't mean that they wouldn't have confiscated it from you. If I give it back to you, they come after you as well and take it from you. Benamale, so the owner can say back to him, Ihadrata Nihale, had you returned it to me in timely fashion, of Ariknale La Agma, again, I would have taken it out to the swamps and hidden it so Beit Din couldn't get their hands on it. So Mishum Damerle, because the Shoel can say back to him in the end, so Falav Me'aliyah, Hava Mishtalme, he says in the end, you have to pay from your own possessions. Meaning that it doesn't really matter. The goof of the animal only matters with regards to a tom. The goof of the animal does not matter when it comes to paying for a muad. In the case of muad, all of your possessions are encumbered to this nezek. So why does it matter that Beit Din grabbed the animal? Had they not grabbed the animal, they'd come after your other property. So Gemara says, "Aniche chadit le'nichse." That works well, or that claim is okay if he has other possessions. Hechadit le'nichse, if he has no other possessions besides this animal, ma'ika le'meimar, then what claim does the shoel have over here? The shoel is actually causing him a problem by allowing the short to be taken by the Beit Din. Mishum damalek, hechadit mishtabna le'didach, hachaname mishtabna le'heich. Because the Shoel can say to the owners, just like I am encumbered to you, so too I am encumbered to the party that was damaged, the Nizak, Mid Rabbi Notan, because of the din of Rabbi Notan, which is the transitive property of debt. Titanya, Rabbi Notan Omer, Minayin Noshe Bechavereo Maneh, Bechavereo Bechavereo. Well, how do you know that if creditor A is owed money by B, and B is a creditor to C, then in the end, that A can go directly to C and get the money paid, or it's a see-through transaction. So that even though they go through different stages of borrowing, meaning that C is borrowing from B and B is borrowing from A, nevertheless, in the end, A is ultimately the creditor to C, based on Rabbi Natan, this transitive property of debt, which is that you can collect from directly A from C. He learns out of the pasuk that the ultimate one who is the one that is owed the money, that's where it goes to. And so too over here. So since I am responsible to the Balim over here, and the Balim are now responsible to the Nizak, so that becomes a transitive property of obligation. And so therefore I can then go directly to the Nizak and give him the shor, because I'm chayav to give you the shor, and you're chayav to give the shor to the Nizak. So in that instance, I did nothing wrong by allowing the Beit Din to confiscate it or give it to the Nizak because of this transitive property. And from this, the Rashba concludes a number of items with regards to Shibuda the Rabbi Natan. The first thing the Rashba notes is that based on our Gemara, now we know with regards to Shibuda the Rabbi Natan, that the final debtor is allowed to go to the primary creditor and give him this money, even Shlo Tavo B'din, even if he never took him to court, even though he never asked him for the money. That means that here, the Shoel is allowed to give it to the Nizak, despite the fact that the Nizak never came and asked for it. Number two is that the Shibud de Rabbi Natan only applies when there's no other free and clear assets to take from the middle creditor. Because if there are assets that are in the middle creditor owned by them, they're free and clear. This is clearly a property that is Mishubad. And we always go after B'nai Chorim before we go after Mishubad property. So in this case, then debtor C would not be able to give it back to creditor A if creditor B had property with which to pay creditor A. The last thing is that we see now this din of Shibud de Rabbi Natan is not only applicable with regards to debt, but it's also applicable with regards to a pikadon. Because over here, the Shoel is holding this as a caretaker for the Baalim, and despite the fact that he is only holding it as a pikadon, he still has an obligation under Shibud de Rabbi Natan to give it to the ultimate creditor. Now the Gemara continues with the latter half of the Braita and says that the latter half of Braita presents a problem for the early half of the Braita, which is, Huad Babet Shoel, if it became a Mu'ad in the house of the Shoel, Bechziro the Baalim, and then he returns it to the original owners, Baalim Mishalim Chatzi Nezek Bishoel Patur Miklum. It's as if there's a reset on the animal, and it goes back to being a Tam when it goes back to the original owner. So Gemara says, Seifa Rishut Mishaneh. In the latter half of the Braita, it seems like when you change ownership, that resets the shore back to being a Tam. Reisha, on the other hand, in the Reisha, where it came out of the house of the Baalim and went to the Shoel, over there we don't say there's any reset, and therefore Rishut Einu Mishaneh. There, when you change possession of it or who was in control of it, there we didn't have a reset on the Tam. It was a Mu'ad in the house of the Baalim. It remains a Mu'ad in the house of the Shoel. So you have a stira within the Mishnah. You have a stira within the Braita. The earlier part of the Braita seems to say that change of ownership has no impact. Whereas the latter half of the Braita says change of ownership does have an impact. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Tavra, Mishboroto, break it. In other words, we have to separate the attribution here and say that there are two authors to this Braita. Mishishanazo, Loshanazo. Whoever learned the first half of the Braita did not learn the second half of the Braita. So Rabbi Yochanan's solution is to say that you have a Braita that has two authors to it, or there are two opinions in this Braita. Rabba Amar, Midresha Rishut Eina Mishaneh, Seifanami Rishut Eina Mishaneh. That if the first case in that Braita shows you that change of ownership has no impact, so too in the latter half, change of ownership has no impact. But then, why in the Seifa, when you return it to the original owners, does it go back to being a Tam? The Seifa Einu Taima Mishum Damarle, because the owner can say to the Shoel, Lav Kol Gominach, Demiyadit Leilu Torai. I didn't lend you my shore to make it into a Mu'ad. I never granted you those rights. And since you don't have those rights, the Shoel can't change the status of the shore for the Baalim. And so when it goes back to the Baalim, it goes back as a Tam because the Shoel was never granted those rights. Rav Papa, on the other hand, says, Mide Seifa Rishut Mishaneh. Since in the latter half of the Braita, it's clear that change of ownership changes the dynamic. Reisha Nami Rishut Mishaneh. So too in the Reisha, we will say the same thing, that the change of ownership does change it. So then why does it stay the same when the owners give it to the Shoel? Because over there, from the Reisha, when it was a Mu'ad under the Baalim, and then he gives it to the Shoel, the animal remains under the auspices of the original owners, or the original owner's name or status granted the animal still remains with the animal when it moves to the Shoel. That's not true in the reverse. When the Shoel changes the status and gives it back to Baalim, that transference of the status does not go back to the Baalim because the Shoel doesn't have that right or doesn't have the ability to create something that is sustainable within the animal. So here you have three different views as to solve the stira in the Braita. Rabbi Yochanan says, Eino Chanami, there is a stira, and therefore there's two authors to the Braita. Rabba says that everybody agrees, Mishut Eino Mishaneh. And that the Seifa, you have a claim, which is the Shoel has no right to change the status of the animal. Rav Papa says that everybody agrees that Rishut is Mishaneh, and the reason it doesn't impact in the Reisha is because it's going from the Balim to the Shoel. In that case, the Shein Balim, or the status granted by the Balim to the animal, doesn't go away when it's just lent to someone else. So the Rashba over here asks from what we saw in yesterday's daf, which is that when it comes to an apitropos, shalacheres shotev katan, that we appoint the guardian for those individuals in order to be miyaed, in order to make the shore into a muad. So according to Rabba's explanation, which says that a third party cannot change the status for the balim, over here the shoel has no rights to change the status for the balim. How come by the case of the apitropos do we say that the apitropos has a right to change the status of the animal for the yatomim? So he gives two possible answers there, Ashba. The first answer is that a shoel and apitropos have the same din. But this is the logic over here. The claim over here against the shoel is that lav the achar shechazar l'rishuti. When it comes back into my possession, the fish lo shamarta yafet. You didn't watch it carefully. That he basically is pointing the shoel and saying, listen, you didn't watch it properly, that's why it's a muad. When I watch it properly, it's not going to be a muad anymore. So he blames the shoel for precipitating the problem of it being a muad. And that's the way Rashi explains it over here. So you could argue by the case of the apitropos, if he watches it properly, then, you know, Konami, if it then goes out and does damage and becomes a muad, that in Ochanami, that is a muad even for the Balim. And the same would be true by a Shoel. If he watched it properly, then maybe that would be the case. If the Balim make a claim that he didn't watch it properly, that's the case in which he can make such a statement that it shouldn't be a muad when it returns to me. The second answer that Ashba gives is that an apitropos is not like a Shoel. A Shoel is a borrower. On the other hand, an apitropos is, in a sense, a power of attorney, a guardian that steps into the shoes of the Balim, or in essence becomes the Balim of the animal. That's the whole purpose of Beit and appointing the guardian over here, is so that there are owners to this animal, so there are Balim to this animal. And therefore, an apitropos has a different status than that of a shoel. And that answer of the Rashba would help us to understand the psak of the Rambam over here, because the Rambam, with regards to psak, says, in Hilchot Niske Momon, Perek Dalet Ochotet says, She'alo kishutam, Vuad beBeit HaShoel, and it became a muad by the Beit HaShoel, v'chziru leBa'alav, and he gives it back to the original owners, chazar leTamudo, it goes back to being a Tam. Ho'eo v'nishtanit reshuto b'teila ha'hada'a. Since it changed ownership, then the hada'a, the muad, goes away. On the other hand, there, in Perek Vav, Alocha Vav, he says, shor shu'ad bifnei apitropin. If a shor becomes a muad under the auspices of a guardian, v'nit pakeach ha'cheresh, and then the cheresh then becomes back to having full capacities, or the one who had lost his mind now is of sound mind, Vigdila Katan, or the minor that he was the guardian for now grows up, Afapish Batela Petropos, even now the guardianship is now eliminated, Harin Muadim, they remain Muadim, Kheskatam Shari Bishut Balehem Hain. Because the entire time they remained under the auspices of their owners, or in essence the apitropos was acting in place of the owners. Therefore, when it goes back to the owners, there is no change in ownership. So that difference in the psak of the Rambam with regards to a shoel versus an apitropos is answered or explained by the answer of the Rashba, that there is a difference between apitropos and a shoel. Now the Gemara says, "Shora itzadin enu chayav mita." It comes to a mitador bull, or an animal that is trained to kill. In that case, we don't put the animal to death because it was trained to do so. It's not that it did it kavanatola hazik, because that was what it was taught to do by human beings. Therefore, we will not be subject to a death penalty because it's not ki gach, ela shigachu acherim. I want to know, the maul agave mizbech. In that case, where the shore should eat stadion, the stadium shore goes ahead and kills, so he's not subject to the death penalty, but then can he be put on Mizbeach? Can it be brought as a Korban? So Rav Amar Kasher, Rav says it's fine to be brought as a Korban. Shmuel Amar Pasul. Shmuel says it's no good. Rav Amar Kasher Anusu, because he had no choice in the matter. I mean, he was trained to do this, and therefore he's not considered to be a killer, sure. Shmuel Amar Pasul, Reinevad Bo Avera. In the end, the shore killed, and if he killed, he is Pasul to Mizbeach. So there, machloka between Rav and Shmuel could be on two levels. It could be just a simple question about, in Hekdesh, do we have a higher threshold, a higher standard? And so despite the fact that it's not chayav mitah, it still may not be appropriate or proper to put on the mizbeach because it killed someone. Or they could have a more fundamental machloket as regards to what is the status of someone or something that is considered to be onus. Meaning that over here, we say that the shor is patur from mitah because it's doing something that it was trained to do. It's doing exactly what was expected of it in these situations. So you can't make it culpable. We can't prosecute or execute the animal because the animal in essence is an ones over here. So the question is, when you look at ones, does ones say that it's if there's no act that took place whatsoever? And since there's no act that took place or no avera that took place, it can go on the mizbeach. Or do we say that ones is simply an exemption for punishment? The act took place. And despite the fact that the act took place, we're not going to punish you over here. We're not going to prosecute over here because you have an exemption because of ones. And that might explain the difference between Rav and Shmuel, which is Rav says it's kasher because ones is if it never happened. Or Shmuel says ones is it happened, but you're exempt from punishment. But it still happened, and that's what is posel you mina mizbech. So meitavei mina beima. So the psukim that are in the beginning of Vayikra telling about the animals that are going to be brought as an olah. So over there it has a list of certain qualities of these animals, and each time it says min. So when it says min ha-behima, the Gemara dashes from that means not all behemot are kasher, only some are kasher. And Chazal explained to us which ones are kasher and not kasher. And there are a number of these. Min ha-behima, lotzi et ha-roveya v'et ha-nirba. You can bring behemot on the mizbeach to exclude an animal that was involved in bestiality, whether in the female or the male side. The animal was not subject to a death penalty because we only have one aid here, or with the Balimer telling us about it. So therefore, it's not going to be put to death, but yet it's still pasul mizbeach. Min ha-bakar, lotzi et ha-ne'avad. That comes to exclude an animal that was worshipped as avodah zarah, even though, again, it won't be subject to death penalty. Nevertheless, it will be pasul to go on the mizbeach. Min ha-tzon, lotzi et ha-muksa. From the tzon is to exclude muksa. Rashi over here says that it's someone she'chado la'akriv la'avodah zarah, that it was designated to be brought as a avodah zarah. Others say that it was designated to be worshipped, or that you require some sort of action on the animal, or masa in the animal, to change it, or to be makatzit for this. Umin atzon, from amongst the tzon, meaning that old tzon, is lotziat anogach, to exclude an animal that gored and killed. So again, here it has to be a case where there's no death penalty, because the fact that it only came through one aid, or through the baalim. And from here, it seems like that a nogeach would be pasul the mizbeach. Some Rabbi Shimon, im ne'emar l'roveya, lama ne'emar nogeach. Rabbi Shimon says, wait a minute. As far as ne'evad, and as far as muksa, I understand why they need a pasuk here to teach us this. Because in the case of ne'evad and muksa, the animals are not subject to a death penalty. And since there is no death penalty, we have to have a nimud here that tells us they're still pasul the mizbeach. On the other hand, by Roveya Nogeach, both of them stem from the same problem, which is that both of them are animals that an Avera was done with. Both animals that are subject to the death penalty. Now, there might be instances where they don't get the death penalty, and the question is, in those instances, do they go on Mizbeach? But since they're similar in nature, why do I need both of them? If I knew one of them, I should be able to learn out the other. So, im ne'emar Nogeach, lama ne'emar Roveya. So, if it told us about Nogeach, why do I need Roveya? Mipnei. Sheesh b'roveya, sheim b'nogeach. Because there's a chumrah by roveya in the case of bestiality that there isn't by nogeach. V'yesh b'nogeach, sheim b'roveya. And there's similarly the other way around. There are chumrot by nogeach that don't apply by roveya. Roveya, asabo ones kiratzon. By the case of roveya, whether it was willingly done or whether it was compelled to do it, there is no distinction between ratzon or ones, whether the animal was nirbat, or whether the animal was a roveya, doesn't really matter. In both cases, they are subject to the death penalty, and they are pasul min ha-mizbeach. Nogeach, lo asa b'ones kiratzon. And then by nogeach, that's not true, because we know that shor shelit tzadin, with an ones, is not chayav mita, versus a shor that does it intentionally, where he would be chayav mita. So because of that, if I knew something about roveya, I wouldn't necessarily be able to extrapolate that to nogeach. Nogeach mishalem kofer. Now then, nogeach has a unique aspect to it, which is that the owners have to pay kofer. Roveya ainu mishalem kofer. On the other hand, by the case of roveya, the owners or the party involved here does not pay kofer. Lefikach hu tzrach lomar roveya. For that reason, you need both of them to be written separately, Roveya no Geach, because you couldn't learn one from the other. Tani miat. Now, if we look at this bright, it says, Roveya sabo unes kiratzon. No Geach, lo sabo unes kiratzon. So you see here that the bright suggests that by Roveya, unes and ratzon are equated. Yet by the case of no Geach, that's not the case. Unes and ratzon are not equated. Here we're talking about putting animals on the Mizbeach. And the bright is telling us, according to Rabbi Shimon, that only when it's done willingly, ratzon, where the animal makes a choice to kill, is it then pasul mizbeach. But if it's an ones, it isn't pasul mizbeach, and that would be supportive of Rav's position. And that's what Gemara says, mayuchata lav the korban. Isn't that telling you that by korban, that is the case, that you could put it on the mizbeach? It says, lo, the ktala. No, it's telling you by the death penalty, that the nogeach is only chayav the death penalty when it does it by ratzon, not when it does it by ones. So when it says, Al-Khinami Mistavra, that explanation makes sense. The Amar, the Korban, if you're talking about a Korban, Nogach, lo asa bo ones keratzon, lav ones didektiv, v'lav ratzon didektiv. Wait a minute, what does that mean? By Nogach, how can you be speaking about ones and ratzon? That the animal did it willingly, or the animal did it by ones? In the Psukim, there's no distinction drawn over here by Nogach, whether it was done by ratzon or by ones. That distinction exists by the death penalty, because it says, ki gach, so that distinction only exists within the Torah in the world of whether it's deserving the death penalty or not. With regards to the Korban, that distinction never is brought down or never is discussed. So that can't be what the Braita is speaking about. Mother be that it's speaking about Ktala, about the killing of the animal or deserving of a death penalty. And what it's saying is you still can't extrapolate from Roveya to Nogeach, because what is true by Noveya might be because of the fact that Ones and Ratzon are equated. But that's not true by the case of the death penalty of an animal that was Nogeach. And that Kula might be the reason why there's a difference in the din, and that's why you have to write both of them down. So Amar, now the Gemara goes back to try to understand the Braita, which says Nogeach Mishalem et Kofer, Roveya Inu Mishalem et Kofer. That distinction which you drew between Nogeach and Roveya, that Nogeach pays kofer and Roveya doesn't pay kofer, what exactly, echidomi, what exactly is the scenario? Ilem et derava vekato, if it's a case where the animal was Roveya and then killed the person while they were Roveya them, malik tola bikarno, malik tola birevia. Why does it make a difference how the animal killed the human being, whether they killed them with their horns or whether they killed them in an act of bestiality? Both of those are the killing of a human being, and they should be subject to kofer. So what are you going to suggest here? It's a case where the animal engaged sexually with a woman and didn't kill her. The reason they're not paying kofer in that case is because the animal didn't kill anybody, so of course it's not chayav in kofer. So Abaye explains the case here. The case where the animal was together with a woman but did not kill her. And then they brought the woman to Beit Din because of this act of bestiality, and then she was put to death by Beit Din. Maldutema, what would I have thought? Keman de katla dami. That we would attribute that killing of the woman to the animal itself. Therefore, the owners of that animal should be chayav kofer because their animal precipitated the death of a human being, because now Beit Din put this woman to death because of the activity between her and this animal. So you might think that you're chayev kofer in that case, k'mash v'lan, that you are not chayev kofer. Those would ask right away, v'im tomar ma pasha shor. What are you talking about? What did the shor do wrong over here? He hargat atzma. She caused the problem here. Sharei heviato aleha. The whole thing took place because the woman brought the animal upon herself. And therefore, what did the animal do wrong over here that you're blaming the animal for the woman's prosecution and execution? V'ish lamar. If they explain this case here like Rabbeinu Chananel does, that the animal jumped on her to have some sort of sexual encounter with her, and then she was overtaken by lust or desire, and then she agreed to it. So the problem was precipitated by the animal, or the animal was the one who precipitated the problem for the woman in the end, and that's why we're blaming the animal. Rava Amar, Lolam, the Rava of Ikatlo. Rava says, no, the case here is a case where the animal had biyah with her and killed her. The Kakashlacha, Malik Talabi Karnayim, Malik Talabi Riviyah. You said, what's the difference between whether it killed with its horns or it killed with its having bi'ah with her? Keren, kavanoto la'zik. In the case of Keren, the properties of Keren are that it has intent to do damage, intent to hurt. And that's what it did over here. It killed the individual. Hi, kavanoto la'anat atzmo. Over here, the reason the animal is engaging with this woman is because it's getting pleasure out of it. That's not a tolda of Keren. That's a tolda of Shane. And since it's a tolada of Shane, it's under a different rule book. And that rule book doesn't involve kofar. And that's why there's no kofar over here, even though the animal ended up killing the woman. So my kibbeli gay, what's the machloga here between Abai and Rava? Beregel should darsa al gabe tinok bechatzer nizak. The case where an animal trampled a baby in the chatzer, in the property of the nizak, of the damaged individual, because Shane and Regel are only chayavim b'chatzer and nizak. So it's a case where it's chatzer and nizak to be chayav. And here where the Regel trampled it, that's the question. L'abaye mishalim kofar. According to Abaye, you would pay kofar in that instance because killing is killing. And no matter how the animal kills, you're going to be subject to kofar. On the other hand, the Rova, lo mishalim kofar. On the other hand, for Rova, you would not pay kofar in that instance because only kavanotola hazik, where it's a case of Karen, do you pay kofar. Not in the case of Regel, even though the case, our case over here is really a case of Shane. Nevertheless, it mentions Regel over here, because as Tosfot says over here, Elagav denokad Regel so perk bet nakte ocha. Since that's the example that's brought at the end of the perk bet, the Gemara brings it over here as well, because it's a similar Gemara. But we know that Shane and Regel generally have the same properties or the same characteristics. The big difference between them is that Shane is the Hanata, and Regel is Darka, is the normal behavior of the animal. But in the end, if they perform in that manner, whether it's the Hana'a or Deraka, then the same din should apply. And that's what the Gemara is suggesting here about the machlok between Abai and Rava. Tanya Kavati the Rav, we have a braita that supports Rav's contention over here that in the case of Ones, it can still go on the Mizbeach. Shor Eitz Dadin, the stadium shore, Enu Chayav Mita, it's not subject to a death penalty, as we already learned in the Mishnah, because Sher the Gabi Mizbeach, Meneshu Kame Useh. And it's also kosher to go on Mizbeach because it was as if it was compelled or forced to do this. And for that reason, it's allowed to go on the Mizbeach because the animal, in essence, did nothing wrong. Now, both the Balei Tosafot and other Rishonim now over here that we have a strange thing here, which is we have a machloka here between Abai and Rava. And generally, the Alocha is like Rava, with the exception of Yal Kagam. Yet, despite that fact, if you go back to the Gemara on Daf, Chavavam and Aleph, the Gemara over there seems to paskin like Abaye, that there is kofar by Regel. So how could that be? So the Baal Tosfot answer, the way that they explained in the Tosfot back on Daf Chavavam and Aleph, which is that Rova's explanation here is not necessarily his opinion, but his explanation of the Braita. Abaye and Rova are arguing about what's the right way to explain the Braita. But in the end, the Baal Tosfot say that Rova agrees fundamentally to what Abaye says, is that Regel is Chayav in kofar, as well as Shane being Chayav and Kofar. They're just arguing about what's the best way to explain the Braita that we brought over here. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Mem Aleph, Mem Aleph.